This show is brought to you by Gobble by Kevin Carr, a Thanksgiving novelette of the zombie apocalypse, and you thought your family dinner was stressful. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. This week, I'm going to be talking about the new films Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them, The Edge of 17, Bleed for This, and Christine. Not the movie about the car from the 80s. Something very different. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park. I'll have an interview with a Disney animator who worked on Moana, along with box office predictions, and of course, the home cinema roundup. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Not to make this a news item, but I guess it's sort of news. As you can tell by my raspy Demi Moore voice, I have been struck with a cold, but that is okay. I will still persevere and get to your movie reviews. I just wanted to let you know, just in case, I sound a little bit different. And no, I'm not going through puberty again. No, I'm not finding my fantastic breasts and where to find them. I am turning into a little bit of a raspy Demi Moore type person because I have a little bit of a cold. I get this once in a while, but that's okay. I still go to movies. It doesn't take much effort to go to movies if you're sick. So let's just plow ahead and talk about some of the news. And you know, this week, much like last week, a lot is happening in the news. It's just a lot isn't happening in movie news. You know, you can turn on any 24-hour news station and you're going to get wall-to-wall reports on everything that's going on in stuff I don't talk about on the radio. But when it comes to the movie stuff, it's actually kind of slow. Everyone's gearing up for award season. They're gearing up for the holiday movie season. Things start to wind down at this point of year. We're not quite at the point where you're getting awards announced by the National Board of Review or anybody like that. So let's sort of coast into Thanksgiving with a couple smaller news stories. First of all, Dwayne Johnson has been named People's Sexiest Man Alive, which I think is a travesty. They did not put me in the running for this one. If they had, I would clearly be the sexiest man alive because I am the sexiest man alive. If you doubt that, come to my house and watch me walk around in a Speedo. And you can then make the decision yourself. You can just contact me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. Let me know when you want me to do that. I'll rent myself out for bar mitzvahs, holiday parties in a Speedo, whatever you want. Hey, I need the money. So another piece of news, they're rebooting The Green Hornet. And they're talking about getting Gavin O'Connor, who directed The Accountant. Now, I'm not a big fan of some of his movies. I did not particularly like Warrior at all. But I thought The Accountant was a lot of fun. I thought The Accountant was a strangely good balance between serious film and over-the-top, ridiculous filmmaking. So I could see that in The Green Hornet. Just please, don't cast Seth Rogen. Let's go to traditional casting on this one. You can't cast Ben Affleck because he's already Batman. But do somebody like Ben Affleck. You know, don't give us Seth Rogen smoking dope and trying to be a comedy. That was the big problem with The Green Hornet. Is they didn't know what they were trying to do. And they basically developed a movie that would have worked better back when Joel Schumacher was making Batman movies. Now, the next piece of news, Lin-Manuel Miranda, who most people know, he kind of, talk about somebody who blew up on the scene, who's been around for many, many years. But he blew up on the scene. And he did Hamilton, of course, you know, it's become the biggest hit on Broadway since Cats, basically. He is working on a Disney film with the director of Zootopia. If this is not going to be a musical, I'll eat my hat. This is obviously going to be a musical. We're looking at Disney bringing back the Disney musical. It used to be when they do their animated movies, these animated movies would essentially be musicals. They'd have five or six big production numbers in it. And that kind of ended in the 90s. You saw that when they brought back Princess and the Frog back in 2010. And yeah, Frozen also was a musical, essentially. But a lot of these movies have kind of steered away from that. Well, you know, you're bringing Lin-Manuel Miranda in there, you're going to get a musical. At the very least, it's going to rap. Maybe it's a Disney musical version of Hamilton. Who knows? And the last piece of news, Spirited Away is getting a 15th anniversary re-release. And this is a big deal for me because as much as I love Studio Ghibli's work, I mean, I love Totoro, I love Howl's Moving Castle. I'm a huge fan of Hayao Miyazaki's films. Spirited Away is one that has escaped me. I've never seen Spirited Away. I have these weird gaps as a film critic. It was before I really started doing this full time. I didn't get to see Spirited Away. Looking forward to a re-release, 15th year, and then I can plug that hole that I have in the Studio Ghibli canon. I think there's one other Studio Ghibli movie that, like Princess Mononoke, is I think one I haven't seen. All the rest of them I've seen, at least from Hayao Miyazaki's work. So that's something I'm looking forward to. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Trailer Park. The first one I want to hit is Kong Skull Island that comes out on March 10th.
These are photos of an island in the South Pacific.
The place where myth and science meet. I see trouble
on the way. Is that a monkey?
You knew that thing was out here?
I'm sorry for your men, Colonel. But if you want to make their sacrifice worthwhile, hit us home with proof.
Now, what's interesting is also the release date is interesting on this, simply because the original King Kong remake was a big movie in the holidays, and it was award-worthy and everything. This one comes out in March. Now, March is turning into definitely a tentpole release time. We saw that with Batman versus Superman, which would have been normally a summer movie. It got brought through the spring, and spring movies are tending to do better now. I think we're getting a wider breadth of people attending movies, even at odd times. So Kong Skull Island, the release date in March, doesn't mean it's getting softened or anything. It looks like an interesting movie. It looks like it's got more humor in it. You don't hear a lot in the trailer, but this, you don't hear a lot of that in the clip that I played. It comes later in the trailer, but they do have a little bit of whimsical elements to it, especially with John C. Reilly when he shows up in the trailer. I think it's funny because the King Kong remake that Peter Jackson did was a period piece. It took place in the 30s, which is when the original movie took place. Only it was contemporary when that original movie was made. This one takes place in the 70s. And of course, you know, so you're looking at 40 years later and they're coming to the island and Kong's there and the other giant monsters are there. Of course, Kong would probably be dead, really, because the larger a creature gets, the shorter its lifespan tends to be. I mean, I imagine a 50-foot ape is going to die sooner. But still, Kong Skull Island actually looks like it might be kind of good. I just hope it doesn't get too whimsical and silly so it doesn't turn into something like The Phantom that they made back in the 90s. The next one I want to talk about is Beauty and the Beast. Opens on March 17th.
Show me the girl.
Look at her. What if she is the one? The one who'll break the spell.
Hello. You can talk.
Well, of course he can talk.
Hello, pleased to meet you.
The master's not as terrible as he appears.
I say we kill the beast!
This looks beautiful. I mean, this looks like it's going to be like Cinderella. It looks like the production design and the costuming and everything is gorgeous. My biggest worry about this movie is that it's essentially going to be a shot-for-shot remake of the cartoon. And to me, the cartoon is so pure that to just do a live-action remake might seem sort of anticlimactic. But ultimately, I'm watching the trailer, and every little bit I see, it just looks like it's like it was reshot. And I feel like we're not going to get anything new from it. And that's, I think, the thing that's been bothering me, and I was waiting until I saw some footage and how it fit together, and that certainly gives that feel. So, I mean, I still have faith that it can be good, but I'm just worried it's going to be kind of like, well, I've already seen this. It's just not live action. And they're talking about doing Lion King, like the way they did, like the Jungle Book. When they did the Jungle Book, it's a very different movie. the modern version of the Jungle Book now is very different than the one they did in the 60s. I don't know. I'm still a little bit skeptical on this one. That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Bleed for this and Christine. Take a seasonal trip to the zombie apocalypse. Kevin Carr's new novelettes, Not the End and Gobble, offer a new take on the zombie nightmare. In Not the End, a man wakes up from a coma to find a viral outbreak has sent the world on the defensive. He must escape and learn the true nature of the zombies. The story Gobble takes the readers back to the beginning of the outbreak, which erupts at a tense Thanksgiving dinner. Not the End and Gobble by Kevin Carr are available now. Only 99 cents in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with a very raspy Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some of the new films this week. The first one I want to hit is Bleed for This. Let's just play the trailer and then I'll go on my diatribe here. A promising boxer breaks his neck in a car accident and struggles to heal before the next fight.
Tasmanian Devil is at Kent County Memorial Hospital tonight with a fractured neck.
If you let me do the fusion, I can guarantee you'll be able to walk again.
I need to be able to fight again.
With this severe of an injury. One bump, one fall, and your spinal cord could sever.
We're not done here, Vinny.
I'm getting pretty sick of people talking about me like I'm dead.
Kev, I'm gonna fight again.
No, you ain't, Vinny.
I'm not done. All right, I got more in me.
Before I even talk about this movie, I have to just vent the frustration I have. This was one of those movies that wasn't screened. It was screened for some people, and part of it's because it's from Open Road. And Open Road's a smaller production company. This is not Fox or Disney or Warner Brothers. This is a smaller production company. They don't even distribute their own movies on disc. It goes through Universal, I think. And this one, I think they're really trying to push in a certain way for award potential. Well, I'm a voting member of the BFCA, and our deadline's early this year. It comes at the end of the month. And they're doing nothing to ensure that people see this movie, which is ridiculous. I haven't gotten a screener for it. They didn't do screenings in my area. How the heck are you trying to push a movie without letting critics throughout the country see it, especially somebody like me who's on, you know, dozens of stations, or somebody who's a voting member of the BFCA, if you don't even make it available to you? It's a busy week. I may not get a chance to see it. I may not see it next week because next week's Thanksgiving. This is just stupid on their part. I mean, you can push Miles Teller as a Best Actor nominee for this all you want, but there's a reason why Open Road Films haven't been getting much nominations in the past, and that's a lot because you just don't make the movie available. Oh, maybe I'll get a screener December 15th after the Critics' Choice Movie Awards. It's just dumb. I mean, don't be an idiot. I understand if you're going to do that in March and it's a movie that you just got to get out there and bury and nobody cares about, but I think there's actually people trying to get award potential out of this. So I haven't seen this, and I didn't get a chance to check it out in the theater because I have such a hectic screening schedule right now because we have an early deadline for the BFCA. I can't actually review the movie. I can give you my impressions, and my impressions are it's a boxing movie. The problem with a boxing movie, and we saw this with Hands of Stone earlier this year, is boxers tend not to be the nice little angels that you want to see in a movie. They're imperfect people, and not imperfect in the way that we want our heroes to be flawed. We saw this with Hands of Stone. Roberto Duran, kind of a sleazy guy. He was temperamental. He practically stalks his wife in the movie when she's way younger than she should have been, and it gets a little creepy. Don't get me wrong. It's a little uncomfortable to watch Hands of Stone. In the trailers, they show him going to strip clubs, and when there's like, oh, things are different, he's like, there's literally a scene where he's at a strip club in the wheelchair with the headgear on, trying to heal, and it's almost like, oh, the strip clubs aren't the same without the use of my legs. And it reminds me a bit of that awful movie that came out earlier this year, Me Before You, which it gave you this the message that if you are injured and you have no longer the use of your legs or you're paralyzed, you might as well just snuff it because you can't go diving in Cabo anymore. So you might as well just kill yourself. And there's a certain wow factor to somebody who works as hard to heal themselves. But there's also a certain factor of shaming people with disabilities because God forbid you end up like them. God forbid you end up in a wheelchair. There is more to life than being able to walk around and box. And let me tell you, if I had the choice between living and being in a wheelchair or just being dead, I would certainly pick living in a wheelchair. Not that I want to. I mean, I don't want to be injured. I don't want to be gravely injured or paralyzed. But if that came to that, then that's fine. I've had friends who are in wheelchairs. I've had friends who are paralyzed from the neck down. And it's an insult to them, I think, the handling of these stories. Like, oh, isn't it great what this guy did? He healed so he could get pounded in the ring again. Something about that message bothers me. I'm seeing that a lot in movies. So I still have to say, Bleed for This was not screened. So I'm going to have to say it sucks. Preemptively sucks, but it probably still sucks.
It sucks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Christine. And no, this is not about the 1958 Plymouth Fury that Stephen King wrote about in the 80s. Christine is a nostalgic docudrama that looks at the events leading up to the on-air suicide of a Sarasota newswoman in the 1970s.
I'm a reporter at WZRB, and I'm always on the lookout for a positive human interest story.
We need higher ratings. If it bleeds, it leads.
This is totally at odds with the work that I've been doing. It's exploitative.
Why not try to get me something like this?
So what, get some footage of some fat people burning in a car crash?
Just make your stories juicy.
In keeping with the WZRB policy, complete reports of local blood and guts, TV30 presents a television first.
This is an interesting mix as a movie, because on one hand, it certainly gives a very nostalgic feel to the 70s. Especially if you've ever worked in a newsroom or been close to a newsroom. I used to do television news a couple of years ago. I used to do a segment on the local news about movie reviews. So I saw the behind the scenes. And I never did in the 70s. I think I'd gone to a TV studio once or twice in the 70s or 80s, but the technology is extremely different. But it does have that nostalgia to it and sort of that golden age of news. It's sort of the Anchorman days where people got their news from the TV. Nowadays, people don't, I mean, some people get it from the TV, but they don't have to watch the local news. They can watch a number of 24-hour news channels, no matter what side of the political spectrum you're on. The internet, online distribution of news, there's so much now in terms of choice. We forget what it was like when people really only had three choices if they're going to watch something on television. So this does have this weird nostalgic feel for the 70s, and they deal with the pop psychology, the I'm okay, you're okay pop psychology. It shows what a very galvanized time the 1970s were. And so this woman, Christine Chubbuck, who's a real woman who really did shoot herself on the air. It shows what leads up to that. It's more watching it develop and the fact that mental illness was a much bigger stigma back then and people wouldn't want to admit any sort of level of depression, sort of the weird pop psychology to try to get people out of depression and the conflict of just sensationalizing news. You want to do human interest. You want to do significant things. But look at me today, this week, even though there's stuff going on in election news, there's no news really of real note in the movie world. And you got to deal with that. If you're doing a 30-minute news program, you got to talk about the news, whether it's great news or whether it's really boring, stupid, inconsequential news. And that struggle that news media people who are in front of the camera deal with in balancing sensationalism and hard news, balancing their self-worth as a person and a reporter and the need to get ratings. And that's an interesting examination of that. It's for somebody like me who's in the media, I really was compelled by that. But also Rebecca Hall does a great job in the part. She is not my favorite actress, but I think she does a really knockout job, a really great performance. So it's a little bit of a downer of a movie. But it's definitely worth seeing. So I'm going to have to say Christine kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Fantastic Beasts and where to find them and The Edge of 17.
We're
Kevin Carr's new horror anthology, 13 Turns, brings you a series of stories inspired by H.P. Lovecraft, Stephen King, The Twilight Zone, and classic gothic horror. A man is trapped, forced to murder himself every day of his unnatural life. Necromancers resurrect two famous figures from history for sport. A beautiful day in an amusement park turns into a murder investigation after a mysterious death on a roller coaster. A researcher in an abandoned prison discovers a portal to another dimension. 13 Turns by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store, and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited.
Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Fantastic Beasts and where to find them. Personally, I would like the movie to have been called Fantastic Breasts and Where to Find Them. In fact, I would like people to answer that question for me. Where are the Fantastic Breasts and where can I find them? You know, it could be a website. It could be a physical location. I'm just looking for Fantastic Breasts. They could be chicken breasts too. I mean, let's not be sexist about this. They could be chicken breasts. Chicken breast, a good chicken breast. That's good stuff. Have I run that joke into the ground enough? This Harry Potter spinoff sees a wizard traveling to New York in the 1920s, trying to track down escaped magical animals, and also gets caught up in political turmoil in the American magic world.
You've known for 24 hours that an unregistered wizard set magical beasts loose in New York.
Yes. Mr. Scamander, do you know anything about the wizarding community in America? We don't let things loose. Something is stalking our city. Wreaking destruction. And then disappearing without a trace. Witches live among us.
2016 is going to be remembered for a lot of things. In movies, however, I think 2016 is going to be remembered for some of the most highly anticipated good and bad movies. I mean, something like Ghostbusters was anticipated. People were very curious to see what was going to happen with Ghostbusters for a lot of people for negative reasons. Batman versus Superman was incredibly anticipated. And Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them is probably one of the top three or four or five anticipated films of this year, because it continues not the Harry Potter franchise. It's so hard to say. It's not a new Harry Potter movie, because Harry Potter is, for all intents and purposes, is contemporary. I mean, the books were started written in the 90s, but it's a modern movie. This takes place decades before Harry Potter even comes on the scenes, decades before Voldemort even becomes an issue. But it's a way for Warner Brothers to make more movies. It's very clear when you watch this film that this is Warner Brothers saying, we want to make more Harry Potter movies, because they kind of lost all their franchises all at once. The Batman movies by Christopher Nolan dried up in 2012. The Hobbit movies dried up a couple years ago. So all these big franchises that they have, they're either having to reboot, and the Batman one's a little bit shaky with Batman versus Superman underperforming a bit, Suicide Squad overperforming a little bit. Now you've got the Harry Potter movies, and so this sets the stage for a whole slate of other films. And that's very clear with the movie. The movie has all the elements you'd expect from a movie that takes place in the Harry Potter world. You've got wizards, you've got wands, you've got magic. They apparate here and there. And the big difference between this and especially the Harry Potter movies is it's not a kid's movie, in the sense that, you know, the Harry Potter films, even though they got very intense near the end, were about kids going to school, essentially. So they were a little more relatable to a younger audience. This one's all grown-up wizards. And what's neat about it, and I do like this aspect of it, there's no learning curve for these. The wizards already know how to be wizards. They know how to use the wands. They are not these kids in the Harry Potter movies. They're learning. They're imperfect. They haven't mastered the art yet. These are full-blown wizards doing their thing. So I kind of like that idea. And in that sense, it's a little bit more for, it skews a little bit older for an audience, because it deals with, you know, the adults in the crowd. But kids can still enjoy it. I wouldn't bring a 5-year-old to see the movie. Somebody brought a kid to the, I mean, like a 4-year-old kid to the screening. That was a mistake, because the kid just didn't sit still. The kid had no interest in it. And the movie does have a bit of a slow burn to it. It takes a while for as little plot as there is in the movie. And let's face it, there's not a whole lot of plot. They take a long time getting to it. And I think it's David Yates trying to acclimate everybody to the series. If you remember the fifth Harry Potter movie, The Order of the Phoenix, this feels very much like that. Where The Order of the Phoenix is kind of was a scattered three or four things happening, but no clear direction. There's no real clear bad guy in this. There's no one-on-one, but that's because they were setting the stage for movies 6, 7, and 8. Or 6 and 7, and then of course the split 7 into 2. This is setting the stage for who the potential bad guy is going to be later on, and some of the issues that they're going to be facing later on. Even to the point, it takes them a while to get to the Fantastic Beasts, and the Beasts aren't all that fantastic. There's a couple scenes with some cool stuff in it. But really, most of the effects go to them apparating here or there, or zinging people with bolts of lightning from their wands. And there's some creature, some monster that's attacking people. And it's the problem with that is that this adversary, we'll say, is sort of derivative of a lot of what we've seen. It's a big black cloud that just attacks things. And we've seen that in everything from the second Fantastic Four movie to the Green Lantern movie, and there was that movie RIPD. We've seen giant clouds attacking people a lot. That's easy to do, CGI-wise. This doesn't feel as baked as it could be. It feels a little bit squishy on the inside. Everything's there, but it just doesn't quite hold together as a fantastic movie. It's a good first step, and it's definitely worth checking out, especially if you're a Harry Potter fan. But I'm going to have to say it's just a kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about The Edge of 17. A high schooler struggles to deal with the ups and downs of adolescence, from the petty to the devastating, with plenty of self-perpetuating drama.
There are two types of people in the world. The people who naturally excel at life.
Golden boys.
What's up?
And the people who hope all those people die in a big explosion. When I was 13, it was clear which side of the equation I was on.
Are you even up there?
But that's what best friends are for. I
never need. You having a problem today, Nadine?
Several.
I don't really have any friends at the moment.
Help me if you can.
Life isn't fair sometimes, Nadine, okay? You gotta get over it.
I remember what it was like to be a teenager, and I had some self-confidence issues, but I actually did a little bit better. Now, my sister, she definitely didn't have the self-confidence, especially in middle school and high school. What's funny is there's a scene in this movie where she's 13 and she's got the worst hairstyle ever. I mean, it's she holds up a picture of Pedro from Napoleon Dynamite and she literally looks like him. My sister pretty much had that hairstyle when she was in middle school. And that I got a real kick out of, because I'm like, yeah, that was the worst hairstyle ever. And my sister has natural curly hair. She was trying to figure out what to do with her hair. And that's what a lot of people are. When you're a teenager and you're an adolescent, you're constantly changing and you're trying to figure out what works for you. Unfortunately, it's all out there on display for everybody to see. So working through who you are and how you're going to present yourself, you don't get to go off and do that on your own. You're dealing with adolescence through the process. This has a real John Hughes feel to it, and that's a testament to the movie. It doesn't go in trying to be a John Hughes movie, which was one of my problems with a movie like Easy A. A lot of people liked because it was that nostalgia to John Hughes, but I felt Easy A was being too obviously a tribute to John Hughes, and I didn't find any sort of originality to it. This one is a contemporary story, but it still has a real heart and reality to being a teenager. And part of the way that this is expertly written is there's stuff that's devastating to this girl. But when you step back and you step out of her mind and you kind of pull yourself back from the movie, you realize it's not an insurmountable problem. I remember what it was like when you're a teenager, even the littlest things seem huge. I got a teenager in my house right now. He's 15. And it's amazing the stuff that is a big deal to him. And then there's things that should be a big deal to him that aren't. And this movie captures that. It's very funny, but it also has some real poignant emotions. And because you exist in her head, she doesn't seem like this brittle, ready to freak out kid. Even though she is. But you're along with her journey. And it's a good movie. And there's also some great performances. She does a great performance. Kira Sedgwick as her mom Woody Harrelson as her history teacher, who is very reluctantly her mentor in a lot of ways and her only confidant. He does a really good job in it as well. Edge of 17 rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to have my interview with Disney animator Andy Harkness, the box office, and the home cinema roundup. Yeah. There's something in the woods, something worth killing for. In Kevin Carr's new thriller, Underbrush, four budding scientists work together to discover a secret hidden in the mysterious Kaikman Woods. This dangerous chain of events is kicked off when a student disappears in the woods near a small college. Four graduate students are brought into an abandoned area of the forest for a secretive biological study, which is nothing more than a cover to look into the truth behind the disappearance. Underbrush by Kevin Carr is available now, only $2.99 in the Kindle store and free to borrow with Kindle Unlimited. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies for the final segment of the show. Still some cool stuff in here. Let's not get out of here quite yet. The first thing I want to give you is my interview with Andy Harkness. He's a Disney animator. He has been working for Disney since the 90s, and he's the art director of Environments in Color. And he worked on Moana, and that comes out actually next week. I haven't seen it yet, actually. But it is the movie that deals with this god in Polynesian culture. And I had a chance to sit down and talk with Andy about how he worked with Disney and some of the culture that goes on in the studio and how they differentiate from Pixar. And a part of it was because Andy is originally from Ohio. He's from Marietta. He lived there for a very short time. He doesn't even remember it. But he went to school in Columbus at the Columbus College for Art and Design, which is a big deal art school here in Columbus, Ohio. So I had a chance to sit down and talk with him about Moana and his role at Disney. Explain specifically a little more of what you do, especially for Moana. Mm-hmm. So just the average listener, somebody who's never talked animation, kind of knows what that is.
Sure. So it starts off with an idea. You know, all you've got is an idea. You've got nothing but that. So you look online, you look at reference, you take research trips. And in this case, it was research trip to Tahiti and Bora Bora. Oh, it was tough. It was very tough.
Did you get to bring your wife on the research
trip? No, I did it. That went well. I did it. I know. That was really great. Yeah, I was always like, you know, it's a lot of work. It's very tough over here. You know, I was always telling her that. And all that feeds back into the art. So you just come back with all this information, and research is paramount. That's the most important thing, especially with something like this that's culturally sensitive. It's a, you know, you have to make sure you get it as right as you can get it. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we're not making a documentary too. So it's that fine line.
Most people, I think nowadays, they're still acclimating the fact that Disney's doing these full length CGI movies. And there's in at least in the public's perception, there's not much of a line between Pixar and mm-hmm. Disney Animation mm-hmm. Studios now. Do you share anything? Do you share modeling or textures or anything like that between the two arms?
I would say where the real sharing goes on is creatively.
Okay.
So John Lasseter and Ed Catmull, John's really the, you know, the chief creative officer. Mm-hmm. So he's like Walt Disney, really. He goes between both studios looking and overseeing every project. What John brought in was something called the Story Trust. The directors get the movie to a certain place. They get it all up on reels in storyboard format. Mm-hmm. And then they screen it for the whole studio. And then all the directors in the studio and all the story guys get together in one room, close the door, and are brutally honest with each other. And then the story gets mixed up, mm-hmm. sometimes scrapped, sometimes changed. They do that 7 times before the movie comes out. And that came from Pixar. That's how Pixar does it. Mm-hmm. And artists are encouraged to do that as well. We are encouraged to, when we get our art direction pitches up, to show the crew and get the feedback. Mm-hmm. And you can take it or leave it. Sometimes they don't know, like someone might not know the vision you've got for it, but it's your job to pitch it to them. Mm-hmm. And if you can't convincingly pitch it to them, it might not work on screen. So it's a really open and collaborative, honest process. Sometimes brutal. But what really comes out of it is something pretty great.
There's a history in Disney of going back to previous works and using them as reference.
Yes.
Do you draw from previous Disney? I mean, there certainly looks like there's a little bit of Lilo and Stitch influence mm-hmm. in this
mm-hmm.
movie.
Mm-hmm. For me, the way I love to work is I look at the subject matter, mm-hmm. in this case, it was South Pacific. And of course, there was some Lilo and Stitch, you know, in the back of my head there. But I really wanted it to come from the islands, from what we saw when we visited there.
Mm-hmm. How long did you work on this? When did you let it go? Were you comfortable letting it go?
Yeah.
Because I'm assuming from a perfectionist standpoint, it's never done.
No, no. Yeah. I rolled off the show on October 8th, I believe was my last day. Okay. And I've been on vacation, you know, I've been able to be with the family again and everything. Up until that day, I was still painting a set extension, which is a background painting that will be in the movie, 5 days before that.
Well, isn't George Lucas who said you never finished a film, you abandon it?
You're never finished. Yeah. Never finished. I look at this thing, we saw the screening last weekend, and I look at it really carefully, you know. And
does it kill you? Because you have to notice things.
There are movies that I've worked on, and I'm going to be really honest with you. There are movies I've worked on that I like look at a whole sequence, and I think, oh, no, you know, I could go back and do this better. Mm-hmm. You know, that my wife will say, it's beautiful. What are you talking about? I just saw one thing in Moana. It was like one rock that could have been a little bit darker. It's hard to say anything's flawless, but as close as I could think of a movie being from the first frame to the last frame, where it looks exactly like we wanted it to look.
What do you say to people who want to work as an animator for Disney? What should they do? What's your words of advice?
Well, it all stems from art, number one. Even back in Walt's day, he was hiring artists. He wasn't hiring people that loved Disney. You know, it was more, he was looking for real traditional artistic skills. So that's number one. And never draw from photographs. You know, if you want to be at Disney and you're recreating life, that's the big thing. Photograph flattens everything. And yes, things hold still for you beautifully.
Yeah.
but there's a challenge and you find the dimension from drawing from life, and always draw from life and never substitute 3D tools for traditional tools. Always use traditional tools, drawing, charcoal, painting, sculpture. Have that be part of your repertoire always.
Okay.
It's so, so important.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
And best of luck on Moana.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, I hope you love it.
This was a good interview. I had a lot of fun with this because he and I got along really well. If you want to hear the full interview that will be posted this weekend on Fat Guys at the Movies, it's about 25 minutes. So if you really want to drill down into the minutiae of animation and you're interested in how the Disney world works in terms of creating these environments, you can check that out this weekend on the Fat Guys at the Movies site. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about box office. Last week, I said that Doctor Strange would be good for about $40 million. It made almost $43. Trolls around $20 million, and it made actually $35 million. Trolls had an incredible hold from last week. I think it's going to be eaten into a bit with Fantastic Beasts because the family movie-going element's going to go towards that. But Trolls it was like less than 25% drop from week to week, which was very, very good. And I said everything else would be fighting for third at about 15. Now, that's what Almost Christmas did, and Arrival actually overperformed at $24 million. So it was a good week for movies last week. Did extremely well. Shut-In did not do well, so we will stop talking about that. And like even stuff like Boo, A Madea Halloween, is still kicking with $3.5 million. It's like $70 million, which is depressing, simply because it means we're going to get more Madea movies. But this week, I think the obvious winner is going to be Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. I think it's good for people are predicting up to $90 million. And I see no reason to discount that because I think this is going to be a big movie. This is a movie a lot of people have been waiting for. This is a movie that has a lot of interest from a lot of people. And Harry Potter was such a huge hit. And this, I think, is hitting a sweet spot because it's been about 5 years since the last Harry Potter movie. So it's still close enough that people want more and it can feel like a continuation of that series. It hasn't sat on a shelf for 20 years the way the Jurassic Park movies did to get that sort of nostalgia. So it's got a little bit of nostalgia, but a little bit of newness. And I think it's going to do extremely well. So $90 million, I think, is a very fair guess for this movie. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the home cinema roundup. The big one this week is Finding Dory, part of the Disney juggernaut this year. I mean, Disney has done extremely well. Between two Marvel movies that are overperformed, you have animated films like Zootopia, you had The Jungle Book doing extremely well, and you had Finding Dory, which redeemed Pixar from the sort of disappointing performance of The Good Dinosaur last year. This is one of the big Disney movies, and it doesn't just rehash Finding Nemo. It tells a brand new story, and they go to new places. It starts out feeling like they're going to do the same thing, but they literally take them out of the water. They have them go to different places, and that's awesome. I really had a blast watching Finding Dory. I watched it last weekend with my kids and with the whole family, and it's still a charming movie. It definitely holds up. And of course, there's plenty of special features and oodles of cool stuff on the Blu-ray. You've got mini shorts. You've got spotlights on the animation. You've got sort of the work that went into the movie and sort of the character design and the textures and the real look of the ocean and what 11 or 12 years will do for a movie and why this looks even more real than Finding Nemo. And of course, there's also a nice little spotlight on the Septopus, which is one of my favorite characters from this new Pixar movie. There's also Game of Thrones Season 6, if you want to catch up on that. And 8 Days a Week, which is the Ron Howard documentary on the Beatles. And then finally, Better Call Saul Season 2, which I've learned is more interesting to binge watch than to watch week to week. It feels like watching week to week, Better Call Saul. Nothing happens. But if you binge watch it, a lot more seems to happen in a short amount of time. That is it for this week. I need to go. Next week, I'm going to be talking about Bad Santa 2, Moana, Rules Don't Apply, and Allied. Until then, have a fat time at the movies.